You have the same handouts today until I move on to the 23rd verse. I'm actually believing that some of you are keeping all of these handouts and taking notes on them as we teach and putting them in a binder so that you will have them if and when you ever listen to the tapes again. I could let you have the same one you had last Sunday and say, just keep scribbling on the back. But this is for you to take some notes, and it's the same verses that you had last Sunday until I move out of Romans 1, 21 and 22. This little square, to you that have been coming, is borrowed from Houston Smith, his book, Why Religion Matters. He borrowed it from another source. It's simply to illustrate an enclosed tunnel. And the tunnel vision that dominates particularly the Western world centered in America, but pretty much the entire Western world and on to the world at large. A viewpoint, the foundation of this tunnel being scientism. The left wall, higher education, built upon the foundation of scientism. The right wall, law. Brainwashed in supporting the frame of reference of scientism. And the ceiling that closes it off, the media that parrots the viewpoint of scientism. Science, I can't say enough good about science. These lights, the air conditioning, the automobiles you drive, closer to home, the PSA tests that I can monitor God's miracle in my life. 0.8 is my PSA, and the miracle that keeps demonstrating God's power. Without that, and Houston Smith talks about it also. He thought PSA was an airline until he discovered he had a dangerous, in his case, PSA level as I once did. Science is not what we're objecting to. Scientism. The viewpoint that has possessed the country, and by massive PR and peer-level pressure, rules this country almost with a sway like the medieval church. And the Inquisition is rejection, disapproval, non-acceptance in science, loss of grants, loss of position. And in my case, it's confronted in school, no matter what the academic accomplishments and the scholarships that led me to the completion of a PhD in philosophies of education at Stanford University. Second-class citizenship, if you do not embrace, as a devotee, the faith of scientism. Scientism, those last few words, makes the difference. But the scientific method, if not the only way to find truth, is the best way to find truth. That's the assumption. Science is an experimental process, a constant use of certain rules and procedures to discover the world about us and how to live with it, make it work to our advantage, electricity, the capacity now to blow up the world, splitting atoms and neutrons. Science is not the issue here. But the successes of science has created a mystique that the scientific method is the absolute method to find truth, if not the only one, the best, and that the only object from which truth can be garnered is the object of the scientific method, the material world and the material universe, leading to a conclusion like Carl Sagan that the cosmos, the universe in its entirety, micro and macro, is all there ever was, all there ever will be, and all that is. And the denigrating of any other approach to truth, and the dismissal of religion, the Christian faith, belief in miracles, belief in the supernatural, belief in a supreme other outside this material world, capable of entering into it and influencing it, and even more rejected, to believe in a creator who spoke it into being, as the Bible declares, from nothing, is to instantly create for yourself an aura of stupidity and a position to be looked down upon, equivalent to a prejudice equaling racism. You're looked upon as a subspecies, as incapable of ever rising to the heights, because you're ridiculous enough to believe in the supernatural and in a God who created it all, a supreme being, the clockmaker who made the clock, if you view it as a clock. You're just simply not allowed. Oh, people that are minorities know there are severe consequences today to express openly your racism view if you have it. But any group and any member of any minority group knows that has nothing to do with the subtle body language, looks, suppressions, hold back, genuine and, though mentally deficient, psychologically honest beliefs. There's a difference between logical honesty and psychological honesty. People can be as stupid as a post and be as wrong as a reverse turn from the right direction and still honestly believe they're right. And they have this attitude because of color of skin or ethnic background. You just are a subspecies. Well, in the day's world of scientism, they've taken over. You are a subspecies. And that's why I'm not to the legal area yet. The legal area has no problem at all being tolerant with some fringe, cute group like the Amish, some culturally distinct group that's, oh, nice to send tourists to. The Supreme Court does not jeopardize its position at all to rule in favor of a First Amendment right when it's one of these little minority groups. And the world has no trouble listening to a lot of religious television because it's so nutty on its face. So nutty on its face that they can sit back and look at it like you would visit a pygmy camp in Africa. Watch them have a good time. And they really don't view these people as crooks. I mean, you let a pastor of an ordinary established church go buy a farm for $700,000 or $1 million and pay for it in cash. You'll have every government agency in the world coming in on them, in spite of the fact that church has a right to have all the cash it wants and be better off if it would do that. But there's never a problem with the Amish. They don't believe in banks. You let me try to drive my wagon. I got an antique wagon with horses. Let me get on the 210 with it and see how fast the highway patrol pulls me over. You drive the Pennsylvania roads and highways and turnpikes. You better pay attention because you're going to see an old buggy that's going down the road clippity-clopping with an Amish family maybe bundling inside. We can be tolerant of the inferior. It's not difficult to love somebody that's beneath you. The difficulty is loving somebody that you're equal or better. They know it and you know it. You let someone come along and proclaim the Christian faith and the resurrection of Jesus Christ whose academic credentials match any one of these scientists, they can no longer dismiss it as ignorant, honest belief. In my case, for example, they know I'm too intelligent to embrace something without some kind of solid basis. Therefore, I make him nervous. I mean, if he believes in this resurrection and does it on the basis of long and hard and academically trained research tools, then maybe I ought to take a look, and that makes me nervous. But in order to avoid that, I will say, he's too smart to believe that, so he must be a crook. That's the attitude I'm talking about. The attitude that only inferior beings can believe it. And if you happen to, by hard work and effort, have achieved some credentials that in other arenas would justify respect, your religious conviction has to be something you keep secret, lest you're ridiculed. Or is something that's explained, as my professor explained it, as some vestigial emotional tie to my father, a Pentecostal preacher. Or you're a crook. Because intelligent people could not believe. This is the tunnel we're in. The law supports it, and I'll come to that and show you. Higher education promotes it. And the media bellows it out with the talking heads that most of the time are reading cue cards and don't even know what it is they're telling you on the news. A vicious circle. And I've been on it for several weeks, but I have no interest in turning this cathedral into a science lecture hall for science sake. I'm in Romans chapter 1. Where along with the unveiling of the gospel, this remarkable word, apokaluptetai, out from kaluptetai, covered, veiled, buried, its root meaning is burial. Out from being covered and veiled. Orgy, two words for wrath in the Greek, thumos, which is fire-spitting wrath, orgy, slow burn, boil. Out from being buried, the slow boiling wrath of God from heaven against epipasen, against all, a sabion. Ungodly, it's translated, just non-God awareness. The ability to live with no awareness or thought of God. Ignoring. Go worse, deny his presence. are dikaion, unrighteousness. Well, the only righteousness that's available is the righteousness of faith, so that translates into either falling short of God's standard, which everybody does, or not embracing the way of faith that's unveiled in the gospel. And God's wrath has come to the breaking of the boil time, and he declares that his footprints, his handiwork, and again I want to say, Paul is not debating. He's not interested in an argument. He's simply stating, take it or leave it. No, but I want to study God some more. Well, he's tired of being studied. He survived a lot longer than anybody listening to me or listening to Paul. He doesn't like the attitude. Hebrews 11, third chapter. He got fed up with the people. Because like metal assayers, they kept him on trial. They somehow thought they were in a position to test whether or not he was real. And he was testing them. And they had what he calls a perverse, a pernicious, one of the names of Satan himself, the pernicious one. They had a pernicious heart of disbelief. They would always go to the doubting side of the ledger, never to the believing side of the ledger when it was involving God. They would always ask for more proofs. Always putting God under test. A pernicious heart of unbelief that you could confirm, 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 and in that case, part the Red Sea, sweeten the water, pour water out of a flinty rock. And the thermostat's set at the same place the next time. God's on trial. You don't like it. Now, it's real tough in this generation to find anybody who believes in God. And it's even tougher to get those to believe in God, that do believe in God, to understand he ain't on trial with you. You are. And once in a while, the Bible breaks through with a simple declaration. Who shall I tell Pharaoh, the greatest ruler in the world, is sending me? Tell him, I am that I am. That ends the subject. I can be whatever the hell I want to be. Include more hells if I want to create them for you. We've been through the righteousness part. Oh, you can take the approach of the lawyer that God has to learn as he goes along how to get right until I can finally approve him as right. Let me tell you something. If I were God, you know what righteousness would be? Me. My armpit smelling would be righteous. Or I don't think that's an adequate definition of righteousness. Take a whiff and then die. Not from the whiff, because I'm going to obliterate you. You get one smell and one only. I have a way of being ludicrous about God, but maybe you'll remember it. And while you're sitting there saying, oh, that's awful, you're guilty of the same thing. Any one of you, if you were God, would immediately revolve the universe around you, and whatever you said and whatever you did and whatever you were would be the standard of righteousness. And God, what an awful universe it would be. God, if he exists, and he doesn't have to apologize for anything. He can be whatever he wants to be. He is what he is. Thanks be to God, the revelation record shows him to be a loving and a faithful and trustworthy God who, when he says something, can be counted on to do it. But he doesn't have to be any of that. And with the giving of his son, Jesus cried out on the cross, "It is finished." The determinate counsels of God and the counsels of heaven before the worlds were formed. The Lamb slain from the foundation of the world was God's fail-safe plan for we fool humankind that would misuse our freedom into self-service and rebellion instead of worship of God. And He's been unraveling the plan of redemption and through the cross into that day of resurrection when He burst forth and the kingdom of God with power was born. That unveiling also unveils a wrath of God that is not just future, but is present. I ain't putting up with it anymore, is what Romans is saying. You can keep doing what the children of Israel did, keep turning rocks over. You can keep searching the outer reaches of space. Ptolemy hadn't even formed his ridiculous universe when Paul was writing this letter. We were still in the pure form stage of Plato and Aristotle's concepts. Multitudinous gods whirling around in the skies. But now we have probed the outer reaches of space, the inner dimensions of the microscopic world. And God said when Paul was there, much less now, there's enough in this creation, from my view, God's view, that I've left enough footprints, fingerprints, evidences of my presence. You remember that in the micro study that we've been doing the last few weeks, all of quantum mechanics deals with things not seen. The subatomic world, you don't see it. Remember the story I told you about the Trilons that were watching the soccer game and they couldn't see black and white, so they couldn't see the referees and they couldn't see the soccer ball. It was invisible to them. Finally solved the problem when they saw a bulge in the net periodically and people acting a certain way. And they could imply, though they couldn't see the ball from the bulge in the net, that they were playing a ball game, and a ball was hitting the net. Well, God has the same right that these scientists have, who expect us to believe what they tell us because of the evidences of things not seen. God says He's left His impressions in the creation enough that we ought, like children who have a magnificent playground and study area provided by their father, we ought to at least recognize His existence, stand in awe in that knowledge that a supreme being does exist, thanking for ourselves and the playland He's turned us loose in, and having known Him as God to the verse you have in front of you, having known and had enough evidence just from the creation, apart from revelation, that God exists and made all this, not as God did they glorify Him, a failure to worship God for this wonderful, mysterious, and they've searched it to the farthest reams, furthest reaches. And what's the most recent conclusion that they've come to about the universe? I could pull all these books out and read them again today, but I'm in a hurry to get to one place. What have they concluded? A whole book over here. I don't want to read it. It's going to give you the title. Quintessence. Harken back to Aristotle. Quintessence. Harken back to the fifth essence of Aristotle. Something else besides earth, fire, air, and water, which the ancient Greeks thought made up reality. But Aristotle postulated a mysterious fifth essence. Now they made the term. They titled the book Quintessence, because we now know how to measure speed. We know how to measure the makeup of stars. We know how to measure their movements. We know how to predict their actions and paths. And we know how to weigh their mass. And we don't even know what mass is, but by formulas, mathematics, we can calculate mass. And they know that mass affects gravity. The weakest but most pervasive force in the universe, the one force on which Newton and Einstein, their early theories, the Newtonian universe and Einstein's universe, is dominated by gravity. And that's why it's never been gelled with the microscopic world that's dominated by quantum mechanics and uncertainty activities. But calculating all the mass, there's just not enough mass in the seen world to hold things together as they are. And the figure in this book is 99% of the universe is dark matter. Mass or energy, they're interchangeable, so 99, what we see out here, the multiplied millions of bodies across the sky now, including superclusters that stretch 600 miles, 600 million miles one way. Thick, wide, long. We've now gone beyond galaxies and clusters to superclusters that are like ribbons through space as we extend our ability to look. That's 1%. What you see is 1% of the universe, according to quintessence. And all dark matter specialists say dark matter is at least 90% of the universe. So we get out to the end of things, and we're talking about the not seen. You understand me? The not seen. That which we Christians have been ridiculed for. Believing in the invisible. 99% of this universe is invisible. And we're searching for it. We got another book here. I've showed it to you several times. It's a book about nothing. And it's a brilliant, brilliant L.A. Times science writer that has written this book. It's probably one of the best summaries of current physics you're going to read anywhere. It's all about nothing. Nothing is where everything starts. Without nothing, there wouldn't be something, and nothing ain't what nothing used to be. Now, we assume that the zero has always been part of mathematics. No. Try to find a zero on Roman numerals. Try to find a zero in the older numerical systems related to the letters of their alphabets or Roman numerals. Try to find zeros. Zeros came on the scene. They were declared heresy by the medieval church. Where do you a zero is a naught, you know that? So where do you think the word naughty comes from? Now, naughty is becoming famous. Dealing with nothing is the activity of most of the scientists at that level. They're down here trying to catch bends in the net, so to speak, glimpses of this dark matter. Nothing. Nothing. On each end of the spectacle, 2,000 years since Paul, by leaps and bounds, breaking free from the medieval church and determining never to wear a harness again, science is now concerned with the invisible. Now, how did this happen? The achievements of science in the visible world, I'm going to go one step beyond Houston Smith. The problem and the foundation The problem with scientism is not necessarily scientism itself, but the reputation that science has gained, and the philosophy of scientism means that when anybody comes out of this frame into any arena with the credentials of a scientist, they speak with the same aura and the same authority as the medieval monks did during the medieval church time. That's the problem. If a preacher speaks, be suspect. Now, interestingly enough, in early New England, in the foundations of this country, the local pastors were the most respected figures, and they were deserving of it in most cases. But there's been an inversion. Now you see a TV show with a preacher, doesn't matter, you could have a PhD and five DDs, and be fluent in eight ancient languages. You will just feel the weight of respect go to the scientist. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And scientists have become the witch doctors, the demigods, the demigogs. They can speak on anything. This is a scientist talking. You must take whatever comes out of their mouth as the holy writ of scientism. That's why I have a lawyer, Ed Masry, sitting here in the front seat. He knows. You let a Nobel Prize winning scientist be a witness, the judge's head's going to turn. You let a Templeton awardee for contribution to religion be the witness, the judge won't even know what that is. Higher education, again a rebellion. Most of the highest and most respected universities were started on a religious basis. Take the Twin Poles, Harvard and Stanford. The church at Stanford dominates the Quad, one of the most spectacular churches in Western United States. But the pendulum has swung. The prophets and priests guiding the mind of America, scientism. Well, now God says, and if they had, I would be just as prone and have been as hard on the ignorance of the medieval monks who let their power take the place of their responsibility. And these ignoramuses, when the Renaissance brought manuscripts with the fall of Constantinople, some of which we have back here, westward, and the Bible, beginning with Erasmus' work, and with Erasmus' translation using Greek manuscripts made available with the fall of Constantinople and brought to the West, the Renaissance and the Reformation growing out of this. The heathen languages, these were called. The priests, mind you. Ignorant priests of the medieval Catholic Church condemned these translators to hell for taking God's holy word and corrupting it with heathen tongues of Hebrew and Greek. Because the word of God was the Latin Vulgate. That's the language of heaven. And these ignoramus priests called the original languages of the Old and New Testament heathen tongues that would corrupt the inerrant word of God, the Latin text. Ignorant. Power corrupts. I'd be just as hard on them as I am the science today who abuse the well-deserved aura in their areas of scientific experiments, God's not going to fall off of his throne because you probe his creation. But they rule him out. God's not even allowed to be part of the equation. And they carry the authority, as my professors did, that shook my faith in college, authority they were entitled to be respected for in their areas of specialty. They carried it over to their pronouncements on religion, where they were absolute dummies, just like Stephen Hawking's wife said, and I'd go to the book and read it. The Christian that helped get his life together, PhD in Portuguese medieval literature. The ballast of his life ultimately divorced him, as the book over here records, because of his atheism. And her sayings on Stephen Hawking's brilliant man that he is, and I certainly illustrated both my respect for his brilliance, but the opportunities he's had to not carry himself off the deep end. His wife says, Stephen has a tendency to get into things and deliver pronouncements on matters that he has no competence in. And she had reference to religion. This boy, raised by a communist mother, standing on the sidelines when he was 13 while his friends were converted in the Billy Graham meetings, studying with a fellow student who would share with him biblical passages. And his only comment on the demon of Gadarene is that the Society for the Preservation of Animals would not like that story about the pigs very well. Brilliant sense of humor. Totally ruling God out of any equation. And I've gone through these books one after another. The End of Science. Probably the most complete summary, because this science writer has interviewed most of the major scientists of the last 40 years. So you get personality traits of all of them. One after another, these geniuses, just totally ruling God out. And then this science writer has to cap his discussion at the end by launching an idea of God chewing his fingernails, waiting to be obliterated. And he then closes his book to show their flippant attitudes toward religion. Let me be completely frank here. You read through this book and you're trapped to that last, because it's a brilliant analysis of all the various facets of science, from quantum mechanics to the space explorations. There is only one theological question that really matters. If there is a God, why has he created the world with so much suffering? And here we go again with that same wanting to blame God for the things that... In other words, God on trial. Well, you know, I'm a philosopher. My question is, why are any of us not suffering, considering our sinful condition? Where do we come off on God's debt to remove suffering from a crowd of people that ignore his presence? Where is this half-baked idea that God, who is Alpha and Omega and thinks in terms of eternity? You know, the world, this is what the world loves to do. These money-grabbing people, they love to create suffering, separate the gap between the poor and the rich, and then get on the church for not taking care of the people they made poor. I don't know why people suffer. I know a lot of them suffer because of Adam. They ought to really just beat him to death if they meet him in hell. Of course, that would make it easy for him to escape the heat, so don't quite beat him to death. If there is a God, he says, he created the world out of terror and desperation as well as out of joy and love. This is my solution to the riddle of existence, and I had to share it. Let me be completely frank here. My real purpose in writing The End of Science, he waited until the last line to sneak up on us and tell us this. My real purpose in writing The End of Science was to found a new religion, the Church of the Holy Horror. Being a cult leader should be a nice change of pace from, not to mention, more lucrative than science journalism. If I were not on TV, I would describe this man in ways that would redound through anatomical textbooks for centuries to come. You say, are you intolerant? I am damned intolerant. I'm tired of it. I'm just as tired of it as God. I'm tired of this snide, snot, mental midget attitude of idiots who can't read one line of Greek, one line of Aramaic, one line of Hebrew, have not spent 15 hours looking at the evidence of the resurrection with their snide nose up what they think is the air and is closer to a black hole. And you know, one of these scientists says, it's a book about black holes. Your mother was a black hole. I'm like Richard Pryor. Say what? You talking about my mother? Your mother may be a black hole. From a theory that all things spring from the Big Bang, which was a point of singularity, a black hole. So we've all come from a black hole. The end of science. And the current model of the universe. It's a whole new language. Quarks. And this is what reality is made of. Quarks. Quarks. Up, down, strange, charm, top, bottom. Leptons. Electron neutrino. Muon neutrino. Tau neutrino. I mean, I could go to some churches in my youth and have said that, and it would be somebody interpreting what I just... In fact, there are some people out there that will think their prayers have been answered, that I just got spirit-filled. And I'm talking in tongues. I thank God I talk in tongues like Paul more than most of you, but I don't try to display it in public. I happen to believe in the reality of that experience. And the forces. This is what reality is made of. Quarks, leptons, matter and antimatter, forces, electromagnetic, weak force that causes things to decay, strong force that pushes the quarks together, but by some mystery, it pulls them only so close, and it gets weaker as they get closer, so they never touch. That's the way they explain things they can't make match in the mathematical figures. Weak force, strong force. And then these forces work with particles. And these particles, this is all unseen. But this is the standard model by which physicists sit in front of computers for hours and put parameters with these elements and have the computer work mathematical formulas of the kinds of universes, all the different options that can come from these original building blocks. And these forces have what's called gauge bosons or messenger particles. In other words, the force is felt by these messenger particles. Electromagnetic force, they used to think that electricity and magnetism were separate, and then thanks to Maxwell, They're together. And now, electromagnetic force, the messenger particles, or bosons, are photons. And the weak force has three kinds of messenger particles. Having fun with this? W with a minus charge, and W with a plus charge, and Z with no charge. And then you have the strong force. And because the strong force is really holding together these quarks, they then develop colors for them. Doesn't necessarily mean anything about art. It just means that it's ways of designating the combinations. In order to have them combined in certain ways, they have to have messenger particles that are called gluons that produce glue balls. Now, do you realize how, you know, I could stand up here with the right kind of audience, not with you, and be like the preacher says, well, now the Greek says this, and he couldn't even write his own English letter spelling of his own name in Greek letters. That sounds good. Now, anybody talking like this, you realize what you're made of? I mean, it's hard enough for me to figure out that this is not solid. That this is stuff moving around. And it was hard enough to believe that there were atoms there with space between them. And then to be told that the atoms now have space between the nuclei and the electrons that go around them. And then to be told that below, about 500 million times more down into the minuscule. I mean, so small it can't even be comprehended with a natural mind. That at the bottom of all of it are these things I just told you about. And they mix together and work and interchange. And gravity is left out of that because they haven't yet figured out quantum gravity. But they postulated that gravity, the reason my feet's here, is because messenger particles called gravitons are holding me there. Look, all I ask you to believe in is the Holy Spirit, God the Father, and Jesus Christ His Son. But that's not enough. I mean, there's too much unknown. We've got now, here's where dark matter and quantum mechanics somehow come to a meeting point. Because neutrinos are part of dark matter. Can't see them. No light there. It's all dark. You got to have photons hitting your receptacles to see. And all this is dark down here, underneath these quarks and leptons and forces and gauge bosons or messenger particles. And they've now discovered you've got to go deeper. That all this is somehow, they postulated and seen just one faint evidence at the big atom smasher in CERN, and hints at Fermilab, that underneath all of this, everything is swimming in some kind of soupy molasses called the Higgs field. And the messenger particles of the Higgs field that communicate its impact are Higgs bosons. And like a fish swimming in the ocean, this subatomic plasma, molasses, force, dark matter controls everything. It gives, and we've never figured out what mass is, and they're postulating that this molasses Higgs field is what gives mass. We're in it, folks. We're really fish. We're swimming in a Higgs field. Don't get the idea that all of this is somehow under our feet. It's in you. Your quarks. Your quarks and leptons, Higgs bosons, gauge bosons, photons, W minus, W plus, Z zero, and 8 gluons and a big gob of glue balls. I mean, that's enough to say hallelujah. Now, the average man on the street has no idea what these idiotic things are that are coming out of the mouth of these scientists as they meet in their own session. If an average man on the street went into a scientific conference and listened to what they were really saying, you would go out and say, this is stranger than religion. Let me start conducting healing services. Don't do what the old guy did when you say heal. You'd say, gluons fall over. Glue balls be gone. Thou foul quarks, come out in Jesus' name. When they get out of science to scientism, they don't know quark. Out of the Heisenberg principle and an experiment, I mean, number one, they've proven you cannot, when you get down to these invisible things that you can only see the evidence of, you absolutely cannot measure the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You cannot measure where a particle is and its speed or velocity at the same time. Because you can only measure its position by increasing the light waves so that you can equate it between the peaks of the light waves. So the more intense the light wave, the more you change the particle. So you never know. You can measure the speed, you can't measure position. You can measure position, you can't measure speed. So it introduces an uncertainty in all this subatomic level. Then the famous two-slit experiment, where they shot electrons, the messenger particles of which, photons, through a slit to a fluorescent screen on the other side. A very famous experiment. They would then close the slit. And they had Geiger counters that could measure when a particle hit, and they had instruments that visually could measure the effects of a wave. And there's always been a debate. They still don't know whether particles are waves, whether light's waves or particles. It has the traits of both and interchanges. And when they do the experiment, they find the evidence of particle and the visual evidence of wave. But the thing that just blew their minds is that the particles, or the light waves, would change their activity and seem to know in advance whether they were going to close the slit or not close the slit. Now this spun off into the viewpoint, and I've shared this with you many times, in Philosophies of Education, the final lecture of my prof, whom I respect beyond any preacher I've ever met for his integrity. I owe a great debt to Larry Thomas, my major prof at Stanford, one of the most honest men I know, president of the American Philosophy of Education Teachers, and the primary declarant and exponent of John Dewey's philosophy on the West Coast. And he would close his philosophy of education class with a lecture on the ontology of experimentalism, which is the philosophy behind progressive education that dominates all education in America, or has for the last several years. It's beginning to change. With tears coming down his cheek, he would talk about the only reality is a sea of constant change, and our only contribution to immortality is the little effect we have on the sea. And fly over an ocean, you can tell the difference between waves, but you can't tell where the wave ends and the sea begins. And reality is just that, a constant sea of change. Nothing permanent, no immortality, no absolute truths. The wave is you, and it lasts for a while. And out of experimentalism, in what's called the epistemology of idealism, things then consist only of their relationships. Now, as we've dug into this quantum mechanics, it's a little easier to talk about this. But you describe this piano. All you can tell me is a relationship you have with it. It's hard, well, not to a neutrino. A neutrino goes right through it. It's hard. It weighs. In relation to me, I'm sure that a dinosaur could turn this over without even hardly noticing any more than we would pick up a paper matchbox. It's a relationship. Well, I'm going to extend my sensory apparatus microscopically. I'm scientifically trained now, you can say. I know there's atoms and so on. Well, okay, go on down to quarks, wherever. All you're describing is a relationship you have. And out of the uncertainty principle, Heisenberg and successor scientists, they concluded, which is at one with most Eastern religions, that what we describe as things, I'm having a relationship with this piano. I could get me cornered. I'm going to say, well, okay, all I can tell you about the piano is a relationship I'm having with it, but there's something there and I'm here and we're having a relationship. Not the ontology of experimentalism. Not John Dewey's philosophy. Not the epistemology of idealism from which all education in America incongruently has developed, coming out of Leipzig University in Germany. They proclaim all there is relationships. What I'm calling a piano is but a foci of relationships. I'm part of it and it's part of me. And since perception affected the particles, reality doesn't exist until we perceive it, locate it, and define it. And a whole philosophy from which we have the educational system of America, without us knowing it. Now, it doesn't make sense to us. Because before you're 6 years old, your habit patterns and mindset's already built within you. I've told you this repeatedly. Our language frame is realist in what the philosophers call in theory of knowledge, the epistemology of realism. Verbs change, nouns, subject and object stay the same. I run home. I will run home. I did run home. I am running home. The verbs change. The entities stay the same. That's our language frame in the Western world. So our conceptual structure finds it hard to conceive that even though I can't describe anything except a relationship, there's got to be something there. Now, regardless of language frame, if you accept the authority of the resurrection and the authority of Jesus Christ and the New Testament and the choice of God to send His ultimate revelation in a world dominated by the Greek language, you are committed to the realistic view because He was. But it affects everything religious. God is the great other. We're not part of God, He's part of us. Indeed, it takes the agency of the Holy Spirit to connect us with God and make us one, but He is forever the great other, as Martin Buber, the Jewish theologian, says. It affects the whole religious program. Prayer between the two others, God and us, even through eternity, there must be dialogue between the persons, between the two entities. Eastern religions are based upon idealism. Eastern religions are based upon earlier, but these scientists came to the same view, that there is no permanent reality. There's only the appearance. Move a finger here, kill a fly in China, it affects something in India. All this philosophy flowed out of misplaced authority in scientists when they move from their simple experiment of what the world is and how to survive in it, to taking their credentials of science and making themselves the witch doctors of authority in all areas, ultimate reality included, and ruling God out. Now, there's no illustration of scientism at its worst than Darwinism. Am I boring you? Darwinism. Now, the reason I'm doing this is that this verse you have in front of you says something, and tied into darkened matter, this verse you have in front of you says something very relevant. Because they did not recognize God in the creation, which 2,000 years of scientific experimentation is now demonstrating, because they ignore and rule God out, He, God, mad about it, takes something from them, a faculty given to all mankind, a receiver for a transmitter, sight to see light. There must be sight to see light. And if you look at that verse, I can't keep track of my glasses, look at the verse in front of you before I go to Darwinism. Look at that verse. They didn't glorify God or worship Him for the creation, nor did they thank Him, but became vain in their reasoning, and their senseless heart was darkened. That word, asinatos, we've talked about, translated senseless here, which the A in front of it means the removal of sunatos. And sunatos is insight, a faculty. And if you think about the word insight, it's more than just sight. Insight is an ability to intuitively see and know. Insight is taken from them. Because they refuse to see the God who created and acknowledge His existence and thank Him, the wrath of God goes to work now. Fed up with that pernicious heart of unbelief, He withdraws a faculty. That's the wrath of God now. He withdraws a faculty until they no longer could find God or see God if He was in front of them. If they leaned over a precipice and there was the face of God, they would give it a new definition. It'd be some new bosun. They would not have the ability. It's a removal of a faculty. Not just arbitrarily by God, because they didn't see Him instantly. Read the words that go before it. Became vain. My Thison. I want to just take a minute before I go to Darwin. You still with me?
Yes,
sir. Take a minute to go to this word being translated, became vain. They become vain. The tiles. Outside the New Testament, it denotes the world of appearance as distinct from that of being. This is the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. What is called metaios, a word, does not rest on the causes which it alleges, but is deceptive. In metaios is always the implication of what is against the norm, unexpected, offending what ought to be, a rebellious attitude, worthless because deceptive or ineffectual. The basic sense always means to fumble or to grope. And much of the time is translated foolish or fool. That's out of ancient Greek. When the Old Testament encountered the word, and the Septuagint translated the Old Testament, I read from this dictionary. It's as though a considerable number of Greek words, or rather of Hebrew words, had been waiting to pour their negative content into this Greek word, Matthias. It's like, here's the Old Testament, and we're translating into the New Testament, or translating into the Greek, which will become the language of the New Testament, and it's like the many words for faith in the Old Testament poured into pisteo, the word for faith in the New Testament. Words in the Hebrew, many words, describing this kind of perverse, pernicious, deceptive, self-serving kind of reasoning, challenging everything, elevating the self, intellectual show-offiness, all of those words in the Hebrew waited to be poured into Matthias. Especially above, which denotes a breath of wind. Now, did you catch that? The root that is translated most often by Matthias has as its root hot air. Hot air. But deceptive and deliberately so. Listen close. In the New Testament, there's no mitigation of the ruthless comprehensiveness of the Septuagint. It's a biblical truth that even in the most favorable circumstances, human reflection does not escape Matthias. It has the basic sense of unreal or vain, as in always in violation of the first commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. Matthias, that's the word root here. This is a biblical word. To present what is vain, to deceive, except for one place, it is always in the passive. You receive this attitude, delivered up to vanity, not to nothingness, but delivered up to vanity. And with this state of mind that has the senseless heart in a state of insight having been removed, and in love with self and deceptive in their ways, we now have the word dialogismos. Got it there? These vain, empty, self-deceptive minds that have had insight pulled from them are engaged in reasoning, is translated. The word is dialogismos. So here, let's see what this word is. In ancient Greece, it was an art of persuasion and demonstration and form of question and answer. But in the New Testament, there's no instance of the classical use in the philosophic sense. What is issue is the obedient and percipient acceptance of the word spoken by God, which is not an idea, but comprehensive declaration of the divine will, which sets all life in light of the divine truth. Faith is the counterpoint, and the exact word being translated here is the sense of evil thoughts predominant in the New Testament. It is striking that the New Testament uses this word only in the negative sense of evil thoughts, self-deceptive thoughts, self-elevating thoughts. So what God does with His wrath is turn these people into empty receptacles from which He has withdrawn the capacity to see God if He stands in front of them. He has given them the capacity. They have willfully and self-deceptively and with empty self-serving mouthings pursued their own arrogant self-deification until God says, okay. Now, I'm on the verge of painting a picture of those who find ultimate reality in this community in which I'm going to paint all of these things down to a mirror. So when they look, they see themselves, because this is basically what they're looking for. They have been rendered empty vessels, self-deceived, determined to elevate themselves above any authority, and God just leaves them there. And they become, what the next verse says, pretending to be wise, sophists, they become morons. If you look at the root word and the phonetic translation of it, it's the root for moron. These brilliant people with the capacity to unravel this playground provided by God. Instead, out of self-worship and determination to rule God out of the equation, have become the victims of God's wrath, their senseless hearts darkened, insight withdrawn, until their reasonings are nothing but deceptive, self-serving dialogues of emptiness that make no sense, and they couldn't find the truth if they tried. Now, if you say you're being a bit harsh on them, 71 years of watching their idiocy be harsh on the Christian faith has brought me to that zero tolerance level. And when I see 1 ounce of humility on their part and respect for the religious position, I'm even easier than God. God has let his wrath pour out because they do not recognize him as the supreme being. I'm only asking even playing field. You stood on your soapbox and ridiculed Christianity. Thanks be to God, he gave me the credentials to stand and look you in the face and say, let's take it on. Now, they talk. I only got 10 minutes. Go. They talk about religious frauds. They talk about religion being the opiate of the masses. They talk about religion having no foundation in fact. I could go here where every one of these people, one of these books in quintessence, is quoting Matthew 12. Many are called, few are chosen. Quoting Genesis 1. It's not as though they're not informed. They have willfully. I repeat it. R.C. Sproul. Atheism is not based on facts. It's a state of mind. Atheism is a psychological state that does not want to recognize and bow before a sovereign. You don't want a master. You don't want a supreme being. You want to be supreme. As Stephen Hawking says, if he can figure out what the universe is, he can master it. As a child, he felt if he could figure something out, he'd be the master of it. And he's on record as saying, if we can find the ultimate formula, we'll have the mind of God. They want to be rulers with their peers in a kingdom that must not tremble when God comes to walk in the garden at the end of the day. They want the garden without God. They don't want a sovereign. They don't want to have to face up to the fact there's someone so worthy, they are recipients of grace, unmerited favor, even be in his presence. And they don't want to face up to the immutability of God, that it's always going to be that way. He's never going to change. And you can do as I closed the message the other day. Lieberman, standing and declaring the universe I have made. And God fades into the distance with a sweet smile on, or a sad smile on, her face. They want to be gods. They relish. If it were allowable, they would have titles and robes like medieval monks. And they would carry their scientific instruments to anoint with. They have enjoyed a position of unchallenged absoluteness until they believe their own advertisement. They have no humility. They will not recognize or even allow God to be part of the equation. They make fun of Genesis to be read for humor as a myth. All right. Icons of Evolution, Jonathan Wells. Darwinism holds the same status as Christianity in the medieval Byzantine Empire. Jonathan Wells, a bit about him. During my years as a physical science undergraduate and biology graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, I believed almost everything I read in my textbooks. I knew that the books contained a few misprints and minor factual errors, and I was skeptical of philosophical claims that went beyond the evidence, but I thought that most of what I was being taught was substantially true. As I was finishing my PhD in cell and developmental biology, however, I noticed that all of my textbooks dealing with evolutionary biology contained a blatant misrepresentation. And he writes a book about the icons. The icons. This is not some. He holds PhDs from both Yale University and the University of California at Berkeley. This is not some fluke. Your kids, when they go to school, will face this. When asked to list the evidence for Darwinian evolution, most people, including most biologists, give the same set of examples because all of them learn biology from the same few textbooks. And how many of you, hold your hands up when I hit one that you learned about. A laboratory flask containing a simulation of the Earth's primitive atmosphere in which electric sparks produce the chemical building blocks of living cells produced enzymes. How many heard that? Well, let me tell you, as I sort of cut through it, it's a fraud. I happen to have an undergraduate major, not major, but I had to get a unit major, the equivalent of unit major. Finished it while I was working on my master's to qualify for what I then intended to do, going to Cal and doing a PhD in geography, which changed when I went to Stanford in philosophy. But I do know a little about geology. There are simply no rocks within the lifespan of the Earth that do not contain oxygen. And in order for this Miller-Urey experiment to be done, they put flax and they drained the air out of it because there's oxygen. Then they mixed elements that they thought was in the original atmosphere of the Earth, including methane. And if they hadn't got the oxygen out of that tube, when he lit the spark, it would have been the last act he ever did. And having gotten the oxygen out of the tube, they produced these little enzyme, one of them, just one. And sort of a red, muddy kind of stuff. And as a result, proclaimed that they had duplicated the original atmosphere of the Earth and had proven that a lightning strike could produce life. Now that's the gobbledygook they're telling you. The problem is, it required an original atmosphere on the Earth with no oxygen in it. In other words, create something that is necessary for the experiment, and then, in order to make your experiment valid, say that's what the Earth's atmosphere had to be. And this is experimentation, and this is science that proves the facts. When there are multitudinous arguments that the Earth's atmosphere was formed with volcanic activity, but geology is your final proof, they simply cannot find rocks in the age of the Earth that didn't have oxygen in the atmosphere. Period. Now, and there's no way that this Miller-Urey experiment could explain how proteins and the early origin of life stuff came. Therefore, why isn't it abandoned? Because the Earth is an oxidizing Earth, and they require what's called a reducing Earth atmosphere. And in every textbook, in this book he's got 1999 booklet published to the National Academy of Sciences, experiments conducted under conditions intended to reasonably to resemble those present on primitive Earth that resulted in the production of some of the chemical components of proteins. National Academy booklets. And he concludes properly. Are we teaching? Well, let's go on. 1986, chemist Robert Shapiro wrote a book criticizing several aspects of research on the origin of life. He was especially critical of the argument that the Miller-Urey experiment proved that the Earth's primitive atmosphere was strongly reducing. We have reached a situation, he wrote, where a theory has been accepted as a fact by some, and possibly contrary evidence is shunted aside. He concluded that this is mythology rather than science. Are we teaching biology students mythology rather than science? The evolutionary tree of life, reconstructed from a large and growing body of fossil and molecular evidence. How many have seen that tree of life in your textbooks? Didn't happen. If I were to draw on the board, I happen to have some geology. Starting with the Cambrian. Here's recent time. And let's say this is geologic time. The Cambrian period hits about 600 to 500 BC. Million years. 600 to 500 million years is when the Cambrian period starts. And that's only the last 10%, on up through several different geologic ages to the recent time. 90% of it is still down here. The tree of life should have been developing somewhere, starting somewhere. All of a sudden you have what some have called biology's Big Bang. As I said, when you have a Big Bang, it presupposes a banger, and I'm the only theologian that's ever called God the Big Banger. But I don't even want to buy the Big Bang that much. The Cambrian period, all life, with very few molecular things, maybe analogous to what they are trying to say was on that rock from Mars, it all exploded in this one age, Cambrian. The varieties of life hit there, and what you see thereafter is a brush pile, not a tree of life. And Darwin's finches, for example. How many heard of Darwin's finches? He hardly paid any attention to them. The facts are, a later scientist wanted the aura of Darwin. And then a couple went down there and studied the way their beaks were developing. And when it was dry on the little island among the Galapagos, the ones that had the thickest beaks were able to break the hard seeds, would break those seeds. Now, ushers, another time like that, there's a back seat. When they go out and come in, they go to the back seat. And you know that too, the gentleman who came in. If you go out while I'm teaching, because you've got a kidney problem or whatever, where's Ed? I really don't need to waste this time. Where's the ushers? You want to find the usher that let this gentleman come halfway down on this side or a third of the way down? You know the rules. You get up and go out of here, you sit in the back row when you come back in. This is pretty heavy stuff. It's hard enough to hold this audience together without a distraction. You understand, sir? I'm talking to the gentleman who came in. You understand the rules? I want to hear you a little louder. And from now on, if you have to go out, you come in and sit in the back row. This is a university lecture room. If I get anybody sympathizing here, this is your chance to go before I finish this. You're supposed to school your guests before they come. This is the meanest professor in town. Darwin never did anything with those finches. Now they discover when there's a dry season, the ones with the thicker beaks can break the seeds and survive. And when it's rainy, the seeds are soft, and the ones with smaller beaks survive. And to their amazement, the tree of life is supposed to look like this. Supposed to go up, branch. But they're finding that because El Nino comes along, the weather changes, and it's wet, and it's dry, and dry, and it's wet, and they're finding that the finches are going the other direction. Varieties are becoming one. Tree of life in reverse are going to the roots. There ain't tree of life. They've abandoned that. I don't even want to waste time on it. It's just a bunch of nonsense, even the scientists. And everybody knows the tree of life and the Cambrian explosion. They say, well, they just haven't found enough fossils. Pictures of similarities in early embryos showing that amphibians, reptiles, birds, and human beings are all descended from a fish-like animal. How many heard that? Come on. This is Haeckel's embryos. How many know about that? Let me see your hands. How many have seen the picture? This picture. Give me a camera here. How many have seen this picture? The embryos. How many have seen that picture? It's in every textbook. Your kids are taught this. And it's the embryos are the fish, salamander, tortoise, chick, hog, cat, rabbit, and human. Now, ignoring the fact that Haeckel picked a midpoint past two stages of embryo development to start what he calls his earliest part, forgetting that, it was a fake. It was a fake. Now, I'll find here. I've got to read this to you if it takes me all day. Haeckel's embryos seem to provide some powerful evidence for Darwin's theory that some version of them can be found in almost every modern textbook dealing with evolution. Yet biologists have known for over a century that Haeckel faked his drawings. Vertebrate embryos never look as similar as he made them out to be. Furthermore, the stage Haeckel labeled the first is actually midway through development. The similarities he exaggerated are preceded by striking differences in the earlier stages, which he left out. Although you might never know it from reading a biology textbook, Darwin's strongest single class of facts is a classic example of how evidence can be twisted to fit a theory. He faked them. I find here where it's admitted that he drew them too close. Others knew. Oh, here we are. Haeckel produced many drawings to illustrate his biogenetic law. The drawings show vertebrate embryos that look very much alike in the earliest stage. In fact, the embryos look too much alike. According to historian Jane Oppenheimer, Haeckel's hand as an artist altered what he saw with what should have been the eye of a more accurate beholder. He was more than once accused of scientific falsification by William Hiss and many others. In some cases, Haeckel used the same woodcut to print embryos that were supposedly from different classes. In others, he doctored his drawings to make the embryos appear more alike than they really were. Haeckel's contemporaries repeatedly criticized him for these misrepresentations, and charges of fraud abounded in his lifetime. In 1997, Richardson and an international team of experts compared Haeckel's embryos with photographs of actual embryos from all seven classes of vertebrates, showing quite clearly that Haeckel's drawings misrepresent the truth. And when quizzed about carrying it in these biology textbooks, they're unmoved. For example, Haeckel's drawings are reproduced in 1998 edition of Douglas Fujiyama's Advanced College Textbook, Evolutionary Biology, the education wing. Haeckel's drawings not only appear in Futuyama's book, and the book by Curtis and Barnes, Invitation to Biology, but also in the latest edition of Molecular Biology of the Cell by the National Academy of Sciences, President Bruce Alberts and his colleagues. 1999 edition of Peter Raven and George Johnson's Biology. Accompanies that picture of the drawings that is fed to your kids with the following caption. Notice that the early embryonic stage of these vertebrates bears a striking resemblance to each other. In many cases, the evolutionary history of an organism can seem to be unfold during its development, with the embryo exhibiting characteristics of the embryos of its ancestors. 98 edition of Starr and Taggart's Biology of the University and Diversity of Life, James Gould and William Keaton's Biology Science. One fact of embryology, they say, that pushes Darwin toward the idea of evolution is that the early embryos of most vertebrates closely resemble one another. And Burton and Gutmann's 99 textbook, Biology, Sylvia Mader's 98 Biology, 99 edition, Campbell, Reese, and Mitchell's Biology, etc., etc., etc. Fake. How about the pepper moths? Pepper moths, how many of you have seen that picture? Pepper moths. Pepper moths that prove selective adaptation. How many have seen this picture? Pepper moths in the industrial area of England. See the dark pepper moth on a light, lichen-covered tree, easy to see. And the dark moth on the darkened trees from industrial pollution, not so easy to see. This whole experiment came with somebody releasing moths in the daytime and counting them at the end of the day. And they concluded that the dark moths on dark trees were harder to see, and the birds, therefore, would eat the dark moths on the light-colored tree trunks and not be so prone to see the dark moths, and therefore, at the end of the day, there would be more of the dark moths surviving than the lighter-colored moths that could light on the light tree and not be seen. You understand? And the trees were all dark. Therefore, the dark-colored pepper moths evolved by natural selection for survival. You understand? Now, it's like the beaks in the Galapagos Islands. First, the beaks get big, and then the beaks get little. Then the big beaks get big, and then they get little. And somebody estimates 200 years of evolving new species. Now they're figuring out that they haven't analyzed the species properly. What they thought were hybrid finches are just same species mating. And now they want to reduce the 14 or 13 or 12 or however many they say down to 4, and it's all blown up. And furthermore, Darwin didn't do any of the experimenting. He didn't have anything to do with it. He just happened to notice some finches, and some of the shipmates gathered a few. It was another guy preying on him. Now these moths. And the further experiments, and a lot of the textbooks have dead moths. When photography came along, they get dead moths and pin them on the trees and don't tell you that. Because they have to show the picture of the dark moth on the dark tree and the light moth on the light tree and more dark trees. Thus, more dark moths evolve because the birds don't see them as quickly. And all these experiments in the daytime, ignoring the fact that pepper tree moths do not fly in the day. They're night flyers who rest before dawn, and they do not rest on tree trunks. They don't rest on tree trunks. They find hidden areas up high in the tree so that birds can't find them up there. And all the experiments were in the daytime, and they're carried on, and they take pictures of them with dead moths pinned to the trees to support it. And one textbook writer was questioned, why are you perpetuating this fraud when you all know it? And this Fukuyama, or whatever his name is, says, well, he'll take that into account when he does his next textbook. Another one says, look, we're just trying to get across a principle. They can argue about the details later. A picture's worth 1,000 words, and it illustrates what we've already presupposed. How about the Aeropteryx? The first flying bird found in Germany in limestone, his feathers were there. This suddenly proves that we are sprung from dinosaurs and birds. And birds came from dinosaurs. And they uncovered, you know about the Piltdown Man and the so-called From Apes to Man? I think it was the jaw of a chimpanzee or something and the skull of a modern man determined to be a fraud found near Piltdown, England. Well, Aeroraptor or whatever you call him, and then Bambaraptor or whatever you call him, once they concluded that flying... Here's thought now. This is not experiment, this is thought. There's two approaches to the origin of flight and evolution. That's the top down or the bottom up. I can do a lot with that. Top down or bottom up. Top down, four-legged creatures climb up in trees and trying to get their, whatever it is they're going after. Occasionally they leap and develop traits like flying squirrels. Now, the bottom up, going, trying to catch things, whatever it is, they're two-legged, running and leaping, and they leap up, and flight develops from the evolving practice. Now, that's how evolution says that flight came about. Either top down, jumping, and God help you if you didn't have something, gliding and then flapping, and then evolution does the rest, or two-legged, running and leaping. Ballet dancing dinosaurs. Now, the bottoms-up theory developed because evolution concluded a theory that similarity was only possible because of common ancestor. Therefore, the top-down would not work as an ancestor for birds because birds are two-legged and the top-down starts with four legs. So the bottom-up was adopted as the theory. That's worse than Quark's. That it had to be something two-legged running and leaping that started birds. So they find this Aeropteryx of about the Jurassic period somewhere way up here. And they conclude that's the earliest ancestor and the common ancestor of birds. A dinosaur that's two-legged, got feathers, teeth in its bill, made famous in whatever that movie was with all these dinosaurs. What is it? Jurassic Park. Because they're right, it's Jurassic period. Now, science then concluded that this so-called missing link wasn't really a missing link. It was a unique species of its own. No relationship to birds at all. So they start searching for another one. And they find the Antaraptor, I think it's called. And it was the hit, cheers at a scientific development, found near Piltdown. Artist reproductions that put feathers on it and a taxidermist eagle eye. Feathers, and here we are. The new successor to Aeropteryx, Aeroraptor or something like that, running on two legs with feathers and glaring eyes and a beak, the ancestor of birds. Somebody, and how embarrassed they were when they discovered, somebody glued a dinosaur tail on another skeleton. Yeah, you'll still find his pictures in textbooks. And Bambaraptor's worse. Bambaraptor, they used DNA. Since fossils couldn't go back far enough, they used DNA to prove that this dinosaur fossil found up in Montana was the original ancestor common descent birds. Wells is a cell biologist. He took it on right head on when this conference, everybody was cheering. Everybody was happy. They had found the missing link. But he did DNA samples and found that it was not 94%, not 99%, not 99.9%, but 100% turkey DNA. And the shame-faced scientist who did the original experiment and presented it on papers and held it in the scientific community, shamefacedly said someone must have been eating a turkey sandwich nearby. I wanted to have the time to read and show you through all of these. Didn't. I recommend every parent get this book for their kids, teenagers. How many teenagers have I got here today? Let me see you stand. I'll bet you understand what I'm talking about, don't you? Am I losing you? I want to hear it from you. Now, is this over your heads, teenagers? No? How many of you have been to the museums and I sent you there? I said, when you're 12, you come in here, I'll take care of your faith. How many of you went on the tours before you came in? You saw a lot of that garbage, didn't you? Now, I want to ask you, are you going to be hornswoggled by this crap as you go through college? Sit down. Give him a hand. I want this book. Icons of Evolution. Every single one of them blown apart. And textbooks at the end evaluated because they all perpetuate the same thing. And one person came from China and began to challenge one of these icons of evolution at a conference and got a chilling response. And another scientist told her in America, you don't challenge Darwinism. She says, well, isn't that interesting? In my country, we can criticize Darwinism, but cannot criticize the government. Over here, you can criticize the government, but can't criticize Darwinism. It has been adopted as a creed, and its icons are shaky at best and false at most. Insight withdrawn. Darkened mind. It does not pay to trifle with God and His revelation. God created this wondrous universe, and as I told you last Sunday, without stars, there would be no possibility of this earth and the life that's on it existing, and the chances of stars creating by any of the projections of the standard model of physics of a universe coming into being by chance that has a star in it, one with 229 zeros behind it, one to that. And the chance that this life and this universe go from stars to this earth, and I promised to read and didn't, so I'll do it next Sunday, the slightest deviations that would destroy life on this earth as we know it, and the master weaver, for this earth to exist with the life that is on it, requires those superclusters hundreds of millions of miles away in this delicate balance that produced this earth and the life that's on it. And our God, Hebrews 11:3 on that passage says, faith starts right here. That from things not seen, and we have pushed the frontiers to the area not seen, from things not seen, God by His Word created it in all of its wonder, turned us loose to search the playground and ever grow in awe and thanksgiving of a God who made it for us to be in and to find Him in, and to ignore Him indeed execute him, indeed eliminate him from any part of consideration, is to have God take from you insight until your reasonings are empty and your senseless heart is darkened and you are an object of God's wrath, like someone fumbling and wandering in the dark, coming up with the most harebrained theories, never able to find God. I'm doing all of this to illustrate nobody could be so stupid as to substitute some of their dumb ideas and perpetuate frauds to serve their peer-level ego position. It's like the Egyptologists that would never listen to anything other than the Pyramid of Giza's a grave. Though there's no evidence anything ever buried in, they took their position, they can't back out. The scientific community is more established in their prideful peer-level reviews and fighting for ideas that they have coined themselves than a preacher trying to defend his sermon. Ignore God and go nuts is the message I preach today, and that's my message. Oftentimes, God at your own risk, and not a risk of a terrible future and eternal wrath and damnation. The wrath now, as we go on in Romans, God turns them over, pushes you out, turns you over to a strong delusion, and you believe a lie, and you're damned. It's a pathetic picture of where these great minds with such a wonderful universe to probe, the ridiculous, foolish, vain theories that prove the point that God has withdrawn, that's the only explanation, has withdrawn insight. They couldn't find the truth if it hit them on the head. And they offer these vain theories in place of a faith in God. Fine. I can respect them. Everybody has a right to be wrong. I'll be less intolerant when they start recognizing their idiot ideas are as mythologically based as they say Christianity is. A little mutual respect is what we're talking about. And young people in this church can hold their heads up high. No sense arguing with your teachers when you get there. They don't know what I've taught here. They just swallowed their textbooks whole and are passing on the same garbage. It would be a surprise as you to find out that they're passing on frauds and lies in some cases. I'll guarantee you there's not one in 500 biology teachers that knows that these pepper tree moths are absolute fake photographs and fraudulently set up and has no relationship to the habits of the moths at all. They don't know that. They're passing on what they swallowed. Keep your heads about you and keep your head in tune with God and thank God for His insight and that He picked you to be in a place that you had eyes to see the light and can act accordingly. Have faith in God from faith to faith. That's the way home. It's offering time. I want the same song. I go to the rock and good day, folks. Make your reservation.